The Texas Frightmare episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts, with specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists. They offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. New this week at Fright Rags, they have the Killer Clowns from Outer Space 30th Anniversary Collection. It releases May 9th, and they have four brand new designs, as well as three brand new designs of custom-colored ringer tees made exclusively for Fright Rags. They also have the Ash vs. Evil Dead collection releasing May 16th. Five brand new t-shirts, three brand new enamel pins, including a movable sliding chainsaw pin. And this is the first collection from this, and there are many more to come. So head over to www.fright-rags.com right now. Again, that's www.fright-rags.com. And you can enter code SHOCK0118 at checkout to get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SHOCK0118. So head on over to www.fright-rags.com. Thanks, Fright Rags. Today's Shockwaves is also brought to you by the awesome Nuclear Blast Records and the band Dimmu Borgir. The time has finally come, and after more than 7 years of silence, Dimmu Borgir marked their epic return with the full-length album Aeonian. Out now, available from Nuclear Blast, Aeonian represents the illusion of time and marks a tribute to the band's own past, as well as the Norwegian black metal history. Exclusive mail order editions, vinyls, cassettes, and imports of Aeonian can now be ordered at www.nuclearblast.com. So again, be sure to check out Dimmu Borgir and Aeonian at nuclearblast.com.
Hey, welcome to the Live from Texas Frightmare episode of Shockwaves. Woo! Thank you, everybody. We will number it later, Ryan.
Yeah. It's episode 96. It's going to air
it's
next
96.
Week.
96, yes.
Sure. 96-ish.
This episode is sponsored by Fright Rags, and three of us did our homework and are wearing fantastic Fright Rags shirts. Kane sucks.
Cavity
and
colors.
Didn't read the email, apparently.
Kane is always against the grain. No, but he wears enough Fright Rags.
I did.
So that's totally
it's
fine.
It's true. It's true.
Plus, I got the two that you had, so it'd be weird if we're all dressed as
I know, that's true. All right, yeah, we wouldn't want to be twinsies. Yeah. But in case you don't know
I look better. I look better in my Evil Dead shirt.
We are the hosts of the Shockwaves podcast. I'm Rob Galuzzo. This is Elric Kane, Rebecca McKendry, and Ryan Turek.
Hello.
Thank you guys so much for coming today.
Yeah. On a Sunday at 1 o'clock.
Yeah. No, we're feeling all right.
Yeah.
You know, most of you know who we are for the most part, but if you don't, we're a weekly horror talk show podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Where we usually talk about things we've seen, past, present, hopefully future. And then we have guests on usually to talk kind of about their perspective inside the industry. Mm-hmm. But we're doing something a little special because when we're in front of an audience, it seems like topics seem to go well.
Mm-hmm.
And so Becca, all right, so Becca started the idea by the scariest movies we've ever seen.
Yes.
Right.
Which is very broad. So
way broad.
Yes.
And then we had to distill it down into how many movies,
yes.
What decades.
But then the debate has come, is it what scared us during that particular decade?
Which makes no sense because I was born in 1976.
Yeah, like I was looking like, okay, well, yeah. The 70s, you know, I wasn't
Here's the rules that none of you listen to.
Okay.
I listened to the t-shirt rule,
I was there.
Let's go by decade, yep. 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, mm-hmm. 2010s,
well, it's in the
and pick one or two.
Yeah.
Because we'll probably have lap over. It'll probably be, and here's the thing, obviously we were like four in the 70s.
Yeah.
So it's more like movies that we discovered later on that came out in the 70s mm-hmm. and the same for the 80s mm-hmm. and all that. And I told Elric you could have more than a couple for 80s since that's our key period where we discovered a lot of this stuff.
And I was born in the 90s, so I'm going to be a couple less than them.
So millennial.
So young. A baby.
So he says.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be a lot of lap over, and we're probably going to pick some pretty obvious choices, but...
Not me.
Not Becca. There's going to be some nunsploitation, probably.
No nuns.
Blood Beach
insect
or something.
Porn.
Blood Beach, no.
Favorite.
Is Blood Beach even remotely scary?
No.
No, but you would pick it. Not at all.
But what a poster.
But you would pick it because it's like some sort of weird aquatic thing that lives in the sand.
I can do better than that.
Okay.
Jesus.
All right.
And it's got a nun's habit on.
No.
You know what they should do is, Becca, you need to do an aquatic horror film about some alien creature that swims in the ocean and wears a nun's habit.
Wow.
Because it combines all your loves.
Terrible pitch, Turk. That is awful.
It's a great fucking pitch.
That should be your second feature.
I'm going to make it a bum house tomorrow.
One of the coolest moments this weekend, is he in the audience today, the gentleman who brought me the 35 millimeter? Yes, hello. So this fine gentleman, what's your name?
Eli.
Eli brought me 35 millimeter trailer for Nasty Habits, which is like old Grindhouse Nun movie. And I don't even know where you found that.
And none of us were surprised.
Yes, it's amazing. And it's going on my office shelf and it's like the coolest thing. So I'm pretty psyched.
Thanks, Eli.
So before we jump into this, how's the con been, guys?
I love it.
Let's go to Elric first.
He has not vomited this time, guys.
He arrives at midnight.
She touched my face.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
So, she was the first. There's been a couple since. Yeah. Feels good.
That's how he's saying
after the show,
not going to lie.
You guys can, like Comic-Con, we're going to form a line halfway through the show. You can stand over there. We're going to put a table and Elric there.
And you can just touch his
face. It's like that guy I saw on Facebook the other day. Some guy that's got a look on his face that just sends people into tears. And he goes out to different countries and stands before thousands of people just to stare like this.
Yeah. I am so confused by this.
And then people look upon his face and project whatever feeling they have onto his face. And he makes millions for all of these public appearances just to do this stoic look on his face. And then you see these weeping women and men looking like, oh my God, angsty. And they're feeling things because they're staring at this one guy. So Elric... That's going to
be
you.
Him. That's going to be our
This is
thing.
Like those damn whisper videos I don't get either.
Except I'll be blinking in every photo.
Are you sure this isn't an upcoming Blumhouse production?
The Man Who Stares.
It's not. Because it's the dumbest idea.
like Kraken with Nun Habit dumb. No.
Could we get, is there any consensus before we even get into it? Like when people say, what is the scariest? Even trying to be objective about it. Would we all come up with four different answers if we answered that right now? Like... Because I always think it's just Chainsaw Massacre. It's like if you just had to pick one film.
Wait a minute. You're jumping ahead.
This isn't from Decade. I'm just saying, is there one movie where we would consensually say that's probably the scariest objectively? Not necessarily the one that scared us the most, but no?
I would say Black Christmas.
Oh, hey.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think that movie's terrifying and every ounce of...
He does win. Okay.
Yeah.
But we're in Texas. I was trying to play to the crowd.
But once again, you're getting ahead.
When we get to Toronto, we'll pull out Black Christmas.
All right.
Thank you very much.
So let's jump into 70s, shall we?
Okay, guys, 70s.
All right.
When you guys were born.
And if we have, you know, overlapping titles, then let's just get into it and converse. But Becca, I'm really curious. What is your your 70s title?
Deep cut or my kind of broad?
No. What's your number one scariest
movie from the 70s?
House with Laughing Windows.
What?
Has anybody seen House with Laughing Windows?
I have.
Is it not fucking terrifying?
Movie.
It is fucking terrifying.
Two people raised their hands,
I don't remember
Elric.
It was so scary.
Yeah.
I just remember it being interesting.
This is why I started with you.
Is that Poopy Avati?
Yeah, Poopy Avati. I don't know if that's
tell us, tell properly us why,
say his name. Yeah. So the movie... Oh, wait. This one does have nuns in it. Fuck.
Does it? See?
I rest my case.
I am so on brand. So the movie is about a painter who... It's very giallo. This is like straight up Italian giallo. And it's a art restorationist who is hired to come to this church and restore this painting. And while he's there, this crazy stuff starts happening. People start dying. And slowly, as he's restoring the painting actually kind of reveals the mystery of what's going on and who's responsible and everything that's going on. And that, it was made, I think 1970? Did I write it down? 1976. So at the same time, we're just kind of getting into the post-hippie. So it's got all of this really trippy imagery in it, which is where the house with the laughing windows comes in. It's a lot of like weird imagery. It's got some genuinely terrifying moments in it. So that's, I would say, and this was a late discovery. I did not watch this one when I was two.
There another one when you were young, like from the 70s, or did you not? Because I don't know about you guys, but I found myself, I didn't really see any of the 70s movies when I was that young. Those were all later discoveries. discoveries. Really, the 80s becomes the key period because we're seeing them as they came out.
I'm wearing it. Yeah. Jaws. Okay, like, I probably saw Jaws when I was maybe 3 or 4. Yeah. And that, I mean, like, every body of water for the longest time. And we live on, like, I grew up on the Shenandoah River. So, like, you walk out the front door.
Those river sharks going to get you.
Oh, seriously. Hey, bull sharks can do it. But no, like, you walk out the front door and you're maybe 25 yards from the water. And so, and like, my dad had no regard. And
I just imagine her noodling, putting her hand into holes and having big fish jump out on
them. I'm not kidding. No, those catfish, they're in the river. They're mud cats. They live on the bottom. I've never noodled.
Okay,
no.
Never noodled.
My relatives do. Okay, thank you for asking.
Can I call you Rebecca Mudcat McKendry?
Mudcat McKendry.
Mistress Mudcat, perhaps?
Yeah, really weird, guys. But Jaws. Like, every leaf that brushed my foot, every weird shadow in the water for the longest time is Jaws. And even to this day, I mean, it's where my aquatic horror love comes from, is just this incredible fascination of, I want to be in the water with sharks. I would go cage diving in a second and not even think twice. I would even consider free diving at times. But at the same time, I'm fucking petrified, which also kind of sums up my love of horror movies, where I will always do it and always push myself, but I'm scared to death. Hmm. So, Jaws.
Are you still, though? Like, are any of us still scared by movies?
I get...
No.
Yeah,
really?
I would say...
What kind of?
Once in a blue moon.
When I get to the more recent one, I can say a screening that you and I were both at, that I was like, okay, I can see that we were both a little freaked out.
I think it's... I think the times are changing, and I'm just too old. Like, I feel like I've seen everything, and I've desensitized myself to everything, that I don't get fazed by anything.
Well, I think now it's more psychological horror, things that we have a fear of personally as we get older, that, things that I think about much after the fact, it's that kind of fear rather than something that I'm scared of.
You get scared of real life stuff, like Home Invasion.
Home Invasion movies. Yeah, but I have to say, like, this opens up a larger question about what fear means to each of us. Because, like, the one that I will talk about when we get to our contemporary screenings that I know both Elric and I were on edge for. Mm. Like, I will say, during the moment of seeing that film, I was sitting on the edge of my seat, and we were both very on edge for it. But do things stick with me, like Jaws, where for like months afterwards I was scared to death of the bathtub? Not as much anymore. But things stick with me. Like, I'll think about them 2 days later.
Well, I think that's suspense. Yeah. I think it is a delineation between suspense and fear. And going in and being genuinely scared by something, I think I don't have. But being affected by a great suspense sequence where I'm invested in the character emotionally and I'm actually hoping that they get out of the situation, that still works for me. The suspense and what the director is doing through editing.
Aesthetics. It's often like non-horror directors, to people like Lynch, who can do one scene that could have you like, because they know how to manipulate all the elements of sound, especially like Lost Highway has moments like that where it's not a horror movie, but it feels like a horror movie for a sequence or Twin Peaks.
I thought about that film for days afterwards, mostly just trying to figure out what the fuck happened, but even some of the sequences, it was just chilling.
Cool.
Cold Hell. Yeah. Cold Hell was one of those movies where we talked about
Shudder.
This movie.
Check it out on Shudder.
That's on Shudder a couple episodes ago, but there was this great sequence where this woman is in her cab and she takes on a passenger, and you know information about this passenger, and she's hasn't quite caught on to it yet, and you're just sitting there going, oh my god, turn around, please, look in the rear view mirror, please, stop. And then shit goes down, and it's amazing.
So that's the big difference, is being scared for a character or being scared for yourself.
Right, exactly.
And when we're kids, we're scared for ourselves because we thought the thing was going to come and get us. Yeah. And I miss that feeling. I think a lot of us
alerts. My news alerts on my phone scare me more. They'll just pop up, and it'll be like, oh, North Korea did this. I'm like, oh man. All right, cool.
But you
cool.
talk about
goodbye, everybody.
I didn't actually put this on my list because I look back at it, and I'm like, man, it was fun that I was scared of that. But I've talked on the show before about how when I first saw Demons 2, I saw it at a slumber party, and I was maybe in sixth grade. It was my slumber party. No other person would show Demons 2 at a sixth grade slumber party. Okay, there's one. We're kindred. The moment in it where the demon actually emerges from the television, that like traumatized me, where for a long time after that, when I'd watch a horror movie, I'd be like, what if it actually came out of the TV screen?
That's the 80s, Becca.
I know. Yeah.
Skipping ahead.
Well, let's go back to the 70s. So,
but I didn't put it on my list.
Since I'll moderate
we'll
the 70s.
Order later.
So Elric. We only have 170 so far. House with Laughing Windows.
Okay, cool. So Elric. Me. All right.
Oh, Jaws. Jaws, sorry. Proceed.
I got a couple, like, obviously Jaws and
No,
Alien.
Pick one.
What? One? Well, okay, I'll start with this one. Are we allowed to circle back and do a second after?
You could do a second after, but okay. Pick your one.
Okay, so one. All right, so when I was 8 years old, luckily for me, I had no idea what sodomy was, and which is a good thing when you're 8.
And that's the goal of the show.
I'm still somewhat ignorant. But what I could tell was I did not want to squeal like a pig. And I was 8. And my stepfather and his older boys put on Deliverance. And
is that
was
like a family night?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't want to play Monopoly. Let's watch Deliverance.
Oh, so the way you feel about Jaws, I felt about camping. Like, I knew that if I went camping, someone would make me squeal. And you know, and also when Burt Reynolds like breaks his leg or arm, and the bone is sticking out, I never forget that. Like at 8, I never broke a bone ever because of that. That movie put me on the straight path to never take risks, to lead a boring life, and no sodomy. That's especially in Utah. Like just throwing that out there, you'll go to jail. But that movie is like, and I often wonder, like, because there's a lot of movies. If you start looking at like Hicksploitation, a lot of movie about fear of the redneck, and I often have no idea where that trend starts. Somewhere, you know. Obviously, Chainsaw Massacre. There's films before Chainsaw Massacre.
It started in the 30s because that's when you get things like in the 30s, especially. Well, that was when the Hays Codes kicked in. But before that, you were getting movies about like teen brides and you know, things like that. And they were always set
playing
in that kind
fear
of environment. Even like in the early 60s, you start getting kind of the poor white trash. There became this whole trend of Bayou films that came out.
Mm. Huh. But it's a John Borman directed. He obviously directed probably most of your favorite horror film, Exorcist 2, classic, obviously, The Heretic. This is a master heretic, whatever. It's a master class in like filmmaking, but also tension. Like even though my other pick's more of a straight horror film, but you know what scares you when you're young isn't always traditionally a horror film. Had I seen Chainsaw Massacre then, which I hadn't until much later, I'm sure it would have done the same thing because it's dangerous. And movies, that's the thing I miss about this genre in general, is when you're watching a horror film. I haven't seen the trailer. If you listen to the show, you know I haven't seen the trailer to Hereditary because I'm hoping it's going to have that kind of a buzz. Mm. But where you don't know where a film's going, and it's going to take you somewhere that you can't expect from a trailer where you've already seen every beat outlined for you. I mean, with Deliverance, it's a bunch about these guys trying to get together for one last weekend, and then unfortunately they call the Driver Brothers, and they go down this lake, and it becomes all about masculinity and crisis. So you're just watching like these men who, when it comes down to you, can be macho, but then they like strip that away, and what's left of a man? And it's like the most macho guy there is Burt Reynolds, and he ends up with a broken leg, and you know the chubby guy has to squeal like a pig, and the guy plays a banjo and thinks he's connecting to the local people. Turns out you can't connect to the local people because you're not one of them. And so I don't know, that film to me, it really stays with me, and I think a lot of people don't discuss it in this way, but it scared the hell out of me.
Rob?
Obvious choice, but because of how long lasting it is obviously the Exorcist from 1973.
Did you see it then or no?
No, obviously I don't know how young I was when I saw it, but it was too young. And also I was brought up Catholic, so I went to catechism. Oh. And even just going to catechism kind of freaked me out because you have all these elaborate statues of Christ on the cross and he's bleeding and in pain. And I'm like 10 looking up at this thing like, oh my God, like that's horrific.
That's intense.
So just the idea and just breaking it down in simplest terms as a little kid to good versus evil. And so when I first saw that, now I appreciate it on a much different level, but I think I've only seen it like less than 10 times in my entire life, like maybe 5 total. Like it had such an impact then. What I remember is how it opened my world to try to see other things in that realm. So, so I remember there was a live exorcism on TV. They like advertise it for like weeks on end, like tonight at the news, 11 o'clock, there's going to be a live exorcism.
With Geraldo.
And me and my cousin were the one. Yeah, exactly. It was something like that. And my little cousin and I would always torture him by making him watch horror movies. And we like psyched each other out. We're like, Exorcist is nothing. We're going to watch this live exorcism. And we both like chickened out. We were just like, oh, do you still want to watch it? And, no, we can do it. And so we lasted like 5 minutes into the live exorcism. But ever since, it's a movie I like to revisit just every couple of years. And again, like as you get older, you look at old movies in different ways depending where you are in your life. It's your life experience you bring to it.
Yeah.
And so most recently, I think I saw it maybe a year or two ago, they showed it at the New Beverly.
Yeah.
And I just really fell in love with the Father Karras character. Jason Miller?
Yeah.
Jason Miller.
I mean, that's the thing. Now I'm a grown man and I'm seeing it through his eyes, right, rather than being the age of Reagan. And yeah, it's still one of those films that gets me. And I prefer the theatrical. I don't like the
2000.
I don't know. Yeah.
But there's a couple spider inserts and stuff that I do like. I like Creepy Spider.
Okay. I don't know. I think it just changes a little bit of the pacing of it. Yeah. And, you know, it's just the original one is just top notch, the theatrical cut of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that this is an example of the idea that you just said of what you bring to it determines whether or not it scares you. Because I've mentioned before, Exorcist did nothing for me as a kid because my parents didn't go to church. Like, I had no idea what was going on. It was just a girl tied to a bed throwing shit. And so out of like the movies that I watched when I was a kid.
That's your boiled down Letterboxd review.
Because it was Becca throwing shit.
And now I love The Exorcist because I appreciate it on a filmmaking level and I appreciate, you know, the suspense and things like that. But like if you'd asked me when I was like 12, Exorcist 3 scared the shit out of me.
I agree.
Exorcist did not.
Yeah. So. Yeah, talk about double standards. She likes nun movies, but not priest movies.
And I'm the only one with a nun movie here. But oh, and I was thinking, Nuns and Kraken. That's Deadwater. It's already been made.
Wow! Wow!
Yeah, seriously. I went with Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Okay, good. Somebody did. Finally.
Thank you, Ulrich. because it's a combination of things. It's the kind of madman like element behind the camera. You don't necessarily, I didn't know who Toby Hooper was. I didn't know who the director was. It just worked as its own being. It felt like a very dangerous film. It also felt like a cautionary tale as someone who was growing up. I think I saw the film in my teens and I was like, I'm never going to go on a road trip and I'm never going to go into these places where I'm going to meet random people. It just like, it showed me that there was danger in the world and there were dangerous people in the world. And then once you got beyond those themes, it was the combination of everything that Toby Hooper brought to the table, from the sound design, which grates on my nerves every single time I watch it. It's very hard for me to get through the very first 2 minutes of the movie, where it's just the snap of the flash and then the grinding of the gears. And then you see that opening frame of the corpse draped over, you know, the gravestone. And it is just so, and it's putrefying in the Texas sun. And it's just like, oh, you're just going right out of the gate to fuck me up. I got it.
It's okay. The only movie I've ever seen where you can smell it.
Yeah.
I can smell movie. Like, it smells like rotting meat.
And if you and did the Universal Horror House maze that they did a couple years ago, you could actually smell it, too. It was gross.
But it was like, but it just throws you straight into a pit of madness. Once you get to Marilyn Burns hunched over a bucket and they're just trying to hammer her in the skull with a sledgehammer and failing because grandpa's frail arms cannot hold the weight of the sledgehammer, you're just shaking your head because Toby's camera's just lingering on that and you're just watching them go over and over with repetition and you're like, oh my god, please just get it over with, just hit her in the head. Put this poor girl out of her misery. And then what he does so well is she smashes through the window and continues running. You're like, oh, thank god, okay, all right, I want you to live now, go live. And then Leatherface is chasing after, you're like, oh god, no, we're just gonna go back to this. Now what I've noticed though is, which is really interesting, is that Toby knew where to end the movie. You know, she is running. I think any other filmmaker today, I think they try to emulate that scene, the final girl runs and then the antagonist chases after her, and then they catch up to her and then they bring her back for more horror. And it's like, no, cut. Like, I think everybody tries to go too far when they need to understand that Toby demonstrated like a surgical precision with the suspense and the terror.
Yeah.
And I think everybody needs to look at that film before.
Yeah, nobody's recaptured that ending. Elric and I got to see the 40th anniversary screening in Los Angeles, where
it's
they
beautiful.
Did a new like 7.1 sound mix and they restored the whole thing. And what I remember, we were sitting there and at that very ending when he's, you know, doing his chainsaw dance, that chainsaw in 7.1 is so fucking loud.
Yeah.
And it's like vroom, all around you. And then the abrupt cut to black.
Yeah.
And you just have to sit there for a minute. You're like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. Like, that was something.
That style of ending, though, it was such a 70s device. I'd even say it went back a little bit further to Rosemary's Baby, where it's like this postmodern ending of they have lived, but at what cost? Mm. And it's something that we just don't see today. I don't know if people are as comfortable with it.
There's that great book, Kim Newman has a book called Nightmare Cinema. And, and that's what it makes me think of is this idea the nightmare doesn't end, and those movies are the ones that haunt you because there is no closure to a guy swinging his dick like that. That is frightening. This is like a giant, you know.
Elric knows.
He's been reading Carol Clover now.
I didn't drink that much last night. But, I was sober. It's fine.
But what's interesting is that, you know, I after watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I'd been like so shaken by it that for years after, you know, I would kind of dip into it, but I had not seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. So the memories of Grandpa and the Hitchhiker and Leatherface, you know, they stuck with me, and The Cook. And then I saw Texas Chainsaw 2, and I was like, oh, these are just like businessmen. And I was like, I'm okay with this. They're kind of fun.
And it
completely like desensitized me to those characters. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre is probably right behind Black Christmas for me as like the scariest movie I'd ever seen.
Yeah. Wow. And before we delve into the 80s, let's just do a quickie, runner-up. Because for me, it's a movie I didn't see. I saw it as an adult, and I think I've only seen it once. And that's Don't Look Now from 1973.
That's mine too.
Yeah, because honestly, and I didn't think, I was at an age where I didn't think I could be scared by anything anymore, and I watched that film, and again, I have vague memories of it, but there is one moment where I guess it's like a reveal that scared the shit out of me. Like,
it's the exact ending, and like, I've only had, you know, those cliches like, oh, I, you know, was biting my nails or my jaw dropped. The only time I was actually biting my nails was a green room. Afterwards, I looked down at my hand and I had been biting my nails unconsciously. But Don't Look Now, when that ending and it's the last couple minutes happened, I literally, it was like jaw dropped. Mm-hmm. Like, because what he's able to do, that director in that film, it's dread from frame one to the last frame. So you're feeling this dread. So it's not like necessarily scary, but it's like this mesmerizing spell you're in, and then they hit you with one thing.
One image that's incredibly shocking and scary.
Yeah. You feel it. And we're not going to ruin it because I hope some people haven't seen it, but it really is, it's an amazing film about like not listening to your intuition. You know, what happens if you don't follow your intuition? It's an incredible movie. And I didn't put on my list, because you picked another one, you could do a Donald Sutherland double with Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the remake.
Yeah.
And I think those two have similar feelings, the way you feel about them. Also pretty scary.
Yeah. So my runner-up, I'd say, is Messiah of Evil.
I love that film.
You're welcome, Code Red. Yeah. There's a couple of sequences. The story overall is pretty, it's like nightmare logic, so it doesn't have a 100% solid plot that you can like go...
It's Carnival of Souls-ish.
Yeah. But there are several, it's the set sequences in it, the one in the grocery store, the one in the theater. There are just so many sequences in it that are just downright chilling.
Yeah. Especially because you don't know where these movies come from. Like the best thing we do on our show, I don't know how you guys feel, but anytime we have someone a little older than us, it is so exciting when these guys have seen these movies in theaters before there's any hype. So when we get a chance to say, like we had somebody who saw Psycho in a theater, or with Bill Moseley talking about when he saw a Chainsaw in a theater at a drive-in for the first time, that feeling of hitting something that you have no idea what to expect, it's exciting.
Mm-hmm. I just had Black Christmas and Jaws behind that. Yeah. And I say Black Christmas, I mean, it's personal preference in terms of what I would turn to, because I feel like Black Christmas has, Texas Chainsaw has a little bit more of an edge over it for being really unpredictable and being this kind of really raw, scrappy film. Mm-hmm. Black Christmas is more polished. You know, you're recognizing these actors. You know, the performances are a little cleaner. But what Bob Clark did in all of those kind of moments of drama and humor, too, because there's a lot of humor in Black Christmas, is just really ratchet up the tension and the dread. And it builds into that one moment that Gary Pullen did so well in his artwork on the Black Christmas poster, is that eyeball through the doorway. That is, I think I've recounted it on the show, but I was dating this girl in college, and I was working at Blockbuster Video, and I rented Black Christmas during December, and she had passed out next to me in my dorm room, and I was watching the movie, and that happened, and I leapt out of the bed and was like, oh shit, and my mouth was like over, my hand was over my mouth, and she screamed because she thought somebody was like breaking into her room or something. That's and she was like, what are you doing? I was like, watching Black Christmas. I'm sorry. We had a little debrief that morning at breakfast. She was like, can you just tell me about this movie that terrified you? And I think she watched it later.
And again, no closure. There's no closure to these movies.
Yeah.
Like, these closure, you go home and you have to, it's going to fuck with you. You can't keep doing it.
Yeah.
So.
And Jaws speaks for itself.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that movie is just amazing. Masterful.
All right,
masterful.
So that's all pretty much before we were even old enough to watch these movies.
Or 70s,
so.
Yeah.
80s, baby.
Let's get to the decade of damage.
I just got a sneak peek of Becca. Becca's.
Oh, no.
Oh, man.
I'll lead us off on the 80s.
Yeah, do it.
It's obvious. So I'll just say it in passing, but Nightmare on Elm Street is the movie that fucked me up and got me into the horror genre.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people. But the reason, you know, I've talked about it enough on the show, and so you can go back to past episodes if you want to hear how my cousins forced me to watch it and told me Freddy Krueger was going to get me. And so... I'm going for, and you'll see a theme here, I'm going for one that I've also only seen once. I own it on Blu-ray. I've been scared to watch it since I was a little kid. But it just came up because Basically, I was having this conversation with my friend Brie Grant, who is a huge horror fan, and she had never seen this movie, so I literally just lent it to her, and it's The Entity from 1982. And so all I remember about this, because there was The Exorcist, where it's the little girl getting, you know, possessed by the devil. And then I still don't remember exactly what's in The Entity other than Barbara Hershey repeatedly getting raped by ghosts and not being able to do anything about it. And when it happens...
She's a mom, a single mom with kids.
Did you understand when you first saw it what was happening? Because I didn't. I just...
Yes, I was fairly well, because there's all the, like, you see these, like, invisible
the
indentations of what they're doing to her.
So creepy.
And you know, I just understood what it was. And at the same time, I think they say either the beginning or the end based on a true story. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, holy shit, that happened to a woman. And because it also has no real resolution from what I remember.
Yeah.
But it affected me so badly that I have never revisited it. And I'm a little scared to revisit it, not because I'm scared of it, but because I'm scared it won't hold up.
The first half is really good. The second half is more of an investigable procedural. Yeah. It's just not the same.
Yeah. And it feels like a Michael Crichton movie.
Totally different.
And there is a gentleman, I think there's an actor that plays him in the movie, but the guy that investigated the real entity is Barry Taff, who is technically a real Ghostbuster, and he wrote a book on it and all that stuff. And a few years ago, I interviewed him for a friend as a favor for a documentary, and some weird shit happened in the room, and I was like, I don't want to be around this guy, because he was one step away from the real entity, and our candle fell over, like, weird shit was just happening while we talked to him. So he was telling us really spooky stories, and then venting about how his script for Superman IV, The Quest for Peace, that wasn't used. So he's got a lot of issues in multiple ways, but anyway.
Do you remember the moment in Nightmare that scared you the most? Like, can you remember back then when you were actually watching it for the first time?
Oh, God. I think Tina's death was... I mean, the 1-2 punch of, like, her pulling his face off, which I guess kind of looks goofy now in retrospect, but as a little kid, you're like, holy shit, you know, like... And then just the idea of her repeatedly, like, getting torn apart on the ceiling and her boyfriend screaming and not being able to do anything about it. Like, as a little kid, you're just like, I can't process what just happened. You know, I think that was the one that really pushed me over the edge.
Yeah, I'll follow up. Nightmare on Elm Street is mine. Is my top choice. Just to recount really quick. I didn't see Nightmare on Elm Street. I listened to the entire thing, all 95 minutes or 100 minutes of it, because my parents rented a VCR and they decided to watch it that night and sent me to my room. And to defy them, I cracked the door open and I just sat by the door and listened to the entire film play out. And it was the most nightmarish thing I'd ever heard in my life. because I didn't know who Freddy Krueger was. I didn't know what the cackling was. And every once in a while, there was like a goat, you know, sound. And I was just like, oh my God, what is going on? But I feel like out of the 80s, that was the one film where you had peak Wes Craven, masterful tension and scares, nightmarish imagery. And it was the conceptually out of the 80s, the one film that I think did it right by... targeting when you're at your most vulnerable, which is when you're sleeping. You know, I mean, like, there was, I mean, Wes, you know, hats off to the guy for going, oh, when are you most vulnerable? When you're, you know, when you're down for the count, you know, and you're in your dream state. And I think he created the ultimate boogeyman. You know, Freddy Krueger is amazing.
And it was just from a personal space, too, like his personal memory of creating that.
Yeah.
You see it, you know?
Yeah. It's really, really well done. And just in terms of, like, big studio filmmaking, I mean, it wasn't big. It was a low budget film at the time, but in terms of something coming out of Hollywood and scaring the shit out of you, that was top notch.
I find it interesting that we all had like a weird, not straight viewing of that film. Like, it's not like you just rented it. Like, for me, and I've told it on the show before, it'd probably be my one, but I've got one other one. But the people invited me to watch it. I went over, they had just rented it, but they had just watched it, and they all pretended like they hadn't just watched it. So as soon as I think he's in silhouette with his hand out, and somebody like jumped on me, and I mean, I almost literally wet myself. That was how scary it was. And I would have been so freaking humiliated, but it stayed with you because all the imagery then, even caterpillar in the mouth, this is stuff we hadn't really seen before.
No, my cousins, like, for weeks told me Freddy Krueger's gonna get you, and I'm like, who's that?
That's fucked up.
The parents burned him and he's gonna get out. Like, so I kind of knew everything going into it,
yeah.
And yeah, I wasn't ready. Yeah,
wow, I didn't pick up the Elm Street franchise until probably 3 or so. And by that time, Freddie had become...
I think you meant 3 years old.
Yeah.
You're like, when I got 3...
No, 3, part 3. Dream Warriors. No, I didn't pick it up till Dream Warriors. I started with Dream Warriors. Okay. And so by the time I came to it, Freddie was already a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
And so then I saw, 5, 6, and then I doubled back. So I was much older when I saw at least like a teenager when I saw the first one.
I think we should come up with Shockwave's Baby. Like Muppet Babies.
Muppet Babies.
And it's just a whole little versions of ourselves. And Becca's just like, I saw Nightmare on Elm Street.
Not till later.
Do you want to go?
Elric's over here going, I love tentacle porn.
Yeah, tentacle porn.
I do. For me,
tentacle
that
porn?
Was definitely, tentacle porn. That was one, but the one that no movie I think has probably scared me more with its imagery than Toby Hooper's Poltergeist. Okay, good. Yeah. I know it's controversial coming from us, but I'm sticking with Toby Hooper's Poltergeist down here in Texas.
You in particular, pal.
You know what? I wrote in my notes, this was my exorcist because not being raised Catholic, even though I still think Exorcist is a very scary movie anyway, but what it did is it actually took the elements that are familiar to a Catholic that made that scare the shit out of them. It took that iconography and then did it with the suburbs, which is what we all knew, and it made things scary. The clown's scary, the housing district is scary, chairs suddenly being on a table, domestic imagery.
Death of a pet,
yeah. And suddenly these things became like things that we all knew. Like, if you can make the static at the end of the night scary, then you've got us. And when none of us were scared of that before. Mm-hmm. Like, people, it's hard to remember before the horror movies, like, people weren't scared of the water. People weren't scared of the static on their TV, and now you can never undo some of that. So that film, to me, it's obviously a real combination of a couple people's vision. That's what's interesting about it, because you got the kind of high effects where you can see Spielberg's touch, but then there's just so much gritty and like kind of like Chainsaw, where it's this big, slick studio movie, but it's a dangerous, slick studio movie.
Yeah.
Like rotting corpses coming out, the guy's flesh rotting. Man, there was so much in that movie that, and ultimately what I'm really coming down to is the clown is the scariest thing
it's
I've ever seen
clown.
In my life.
Yeah,
like the arms coming at you, wrapping around you. I was that little boy in that moment.
Mine was the tree because I had a tree right outside my bedroom window, and when the wind would blow, it would actually tap, and that was terrifying when the tree actually came through. Now, that was one that I saw, like you watched Elm Street, where my parents, God bless them, bootlegged every damn VHS we rented until the invention of CopyGuard. So they would set up the two VHS players, and they copied everything until CopyGuard stopped them. So they were actually they were bootlegging Poltergeist before, and I remember peeking out of my bedroom window and watching the entire thing, and I was.
Actual thunder count? Like the stun count.
Oh, yeah.
I actually did that. Yeah. Whenever I laid in bed, that movie gave me the count in between the lightning strikes and the thunder. I just laid in bed and I did that all the time.
Yeah.
Didn't want no fucking tree in my window.
Nice. Yeah, it's a scare. So that was yours as well, Poltergeist?
That was, my number one. So instead of that one, I will go with Watcher in the Woods, which is, have people seen that? Making sure it's not out of nowhere.
Disney?
Yeah, Disney. So in the 80s, Disney decided
to kind of... terrifying things, Disney.
Yeah, they decided to take this weird little foray into scarier material, and they did Escape to Witch Mountain. They did Black Hole. And Watcher in the Woods. And Watcher in the Woods kind of looked like a kids film because it had kids protagonists, but Betty Davis was in there, and it was about these kids who were doing this like play. I'll call it like light as a feather, stiff as a board, but like the 1950s version. It looked like Monkey in the Middle, but I don't know exactly the logistics of the game. No, they were like, they put some girl in the middle, they blindfolded her, and she was spinning around, and then they were like saying these incantations, and she disappears. And then like 20 years later, two kids move into the house, and she's trying to communicate with them. And Betty Davis, her mom, is still there, and it was just, the whole thing was terrifying. And there was this scene, and remember, this was like marketed towards kids. There's this scene where one of the kids becomes possessed with her spirit, and she writes her name backwards on the window, and it was like the 5-year-old version of Red Rum, and she's saying it, she's like, Narek, because it was Karen backwards. It is horrifying. So yeah, that movie, it definitely messed me up pretty bad.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Backups. I did not. Well, Nightmare on Elm Street's mine. My backup would be Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
So bleak.
Again, not my go-to movie that I would watch on a Thursday night.
do you have a good date story about that one?
I do. Actually, I do.
Oh, yes. You took a date to Henry?
No. She requested I bring Henry over, and I said, "Oh, I'll bring it." She was like, "I want to see the gnarliest thing that you've ever watched recently," and I was like, "Oh, let me show you," and it did not go well.
Yeah.
Especially when Otis and Henry were getting frisky with a woman, which is a terrifying scene. And I remember I had my arm around her, we're watching the movie, and then she kind of just was like, "I'm going to get some water." Yeah. She got water. She wanted to see it. But Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, I guess it's just kind of like a running theme with stuff that just terrifies me, which is, you know, these films that are done on a really gritty, almost documentarian level, that kind of shed a light on the darkness of mankind, you know? I mean, like, you've got this serial killer, Henry, who has a moral code that no one else lives by. I mean, like, he has his own rules, and then his crazy buddy Otis, based on, you know, real people. But I think it's just the way that I'm blanking on the director.
John McNaughton.
John McNaughton. Yeah, thank you. You know, the way he documented these men's lives. You know,
and humanized not, without just saying.
Well, no,
that
what I was
going
to say.
Villains.
Yeah, exactly. Taking us into a breakfast scene with these two men.
Yeah,
and humanizing him, and then of course Otis crosses the line, and then you know Henry is like, "No, not now, don't do that."
And then
know.
Henry's kind of like, by the end, he's like Jaws.
Yeah,
like he's like a shark that just looks at situations
is,
in this way.
Yeah, and it's a mind game watching this movie too, because you kind of like Henry a little bit because he does have a little bit of a code, because he's not willing to go that far as Otis would. It's just the levels of evil. And that when a movie asks you to kind of assess that and take a side almost, like, you want to see Otis die. Mm-hmm. Like, you want a Henry versus Otis battle, and you want to see him go down. And then at the, you know, and then in the last act, you know, Henry can run off and actually probably enjoy a good life, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, the darkness catches up to him and he makes a choice, and you're just like, you're just left with this, you know, this punch to the gut. But through that film, I mean, it did terrify me. I mean, like, just because I lived in the big city, and I was just like, I could be walking by a serial killer any day now, you know?
And it was really smart filmmaking, because McNaughton went out of his way at the beginning to establish that Henry was the killer, but they never linked the two together, because for the first several killings, they will show Henry with the girl, then they will show her corpse, and then Henry over here, but you never see it together. Or you'll see the guy with the guitar, you'll see his corpse, and then you'll see Henry with the guitar, but you never actually see him doing the damage for a while. So it really kind of humanizes him and separates him from it before you actually see it.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Henry 2?
No. I chose not to.
Yeah, I watched it a couple years ago, actually.
Killer,
I was curious. Well, you know, I read some, I'm sure it's very accurate information from Wikipedia, that Rooker would have done it maybe if he didn't have some sort of conflict. But it's pretty gnarly and not very good. It's almost like a redo. Just as mean-spirited, but without the craft part of it.
Yeah.
And so it's just a gnarly cash and sequel, unfortunately.
I find it really interesting what scares. I remember meeting, I think it was Landis a long time ago when he did his book on monsters, and he talked about his wife, which reminded me of you, which is some people are just terrified. They can watch anything supernatural, but anything about real life, like home invasions, rape, serial killers, they can't watch it because it's so scary to them. And I feel the complete opposite. For some reason, I feel like with those kind of things, like if a serial killer is going to get me, I'm like, oh, whatever, they're going to get me, I can't stop that, so fuck it. But for some reason, ghosts and shit like really scare me, even though I don't even know if I believe in
it. But you can stop the ghosts?
I don't know. Yeah. I've seen, you know, the Christ, the body of whatever.
The body of whatever.
Something.
The body, that ghost is
not Catholic.
Down.
Sorry.
The body of whatever.
I'm from New Zealand.
Gone.
We don't have religion. apologize. Jedis, I'm saying. We do.
No, it's like Jason or Michael Myers, like you're probably not going to survive, but it's a dude. You can try.
Yeah.
Like ghosts, there's no rules. You're probably going
to. It's unknowable. I like the thing that's unknowable back. And you wouldn't even know what to do except for cliches. I have a really stupid one now that feels really silly, but at the time I was this one moment in this movie scared the bejesus out of me, which was Steve Miner's house. I'm not kidding. I view it as a comedy now, but I swear to God, when that woman came out of that weird, ugly, monstrous woman, I like just couldn't even handle it. I was so scared. And then, of course, Big Ben's terrifying too when he comes. Mm-hmm. But there's something about that woman. I couldn't even think about her like for a couple years, and then I went back.
Well,
to
her
watch
voice
it,
and, too, her little warbly voice,
and then the hand. And then I watch it now, and it's almost Evil Dead 2 like funny.
Oh, absolutely.
But at the time, that movie just scared me, and it's just kind of silly when I would think. And I have to just mention, because we haven't talked about it. For me, The Shining is the movie that actually changed my life in terms of how I love movies, but I don't know if it was scary or if it was just like a spell.
Oh, no. Yeah. The old lady in the tub is the
original. Yeah, the tub.
Yeah, that stuck with me forever.
That's a movie from start to end. You're in this guy's magic spell of just bringing you in.
You know what? We never actually touched on this a couple episodes back. Ready Player One. Who saw Ready Player One?
I still haven't
seen
it.
Yeah, you guys, I'm shocked you guys haven't seen it. The Shining stuff.
I know, I did. I loved it. But it's
incredible.
But I don't want to spoil any of that.
No, I'm not talking about spoiling it, but we never recognized it as something that happened in cinema. Yeah. And I think it's incredible what they went through, because to now doing the Halloween stuff and going through all the right stuff.
Yeah. Brian, sir, producer of the new Halloween film.
Quiet.
Where's the trailer?
Where's the trailer, Turek?
To go through the rights and the level of detail in that. I mean, like, I just applauded that scene. You guys have to see it.
I generally agree with you, and without spoiling it, there is an incredible homage to Kubrick's The Shining.
It's amazing.
It's almost like jaw-dropping that it's a giant blockbuster of that caliber. You're like, wait, we're going to stay here for a while? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, Spielberg owed it to him for dropping the ball in his other Kubrick homage called AI. Dropped the ball big time, in my opinion. Yeah. Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah. All right, what are your other backers?
I got some other ones. Pin. I saw Pin way too young. Thanks. Yeah, that one. Mentally,
couple Canadians here. Yeah.
That one destroyed me when I first
saw it. Plastic
Nightmare. Lady in White was another one where it's like this bucolic movie that I almost...
We appreciate the one guy that clapped for that one.
Lady in White, man. I almost found it boring. Like, I remember being like, yeah, maybe I'll turn this off. I'm just hanging here. And then it gets nuts. And so that one definitely did it. Dolls was a big one for me. As well, just because they were dolls, and the movie in general was pretty terrifying for me as a kid. But the deep cut I'll give here is hard to find. It is VHS only, so dust off your players. 1989, there's this film that came out called Sound of Silence. Sounds of Silence, I believe.
Was that Art Garfunkel?
No.
Okay.
No. Has like anyone in here seen Sounds of Silence? Okay, it is. It's worth the hunt. It is VHS only.
No one?
And
no one.
It is about parents, dad and mom, and their deaf son who purchase a rundown orphanage. And when they get there, there are ghosts, but only the little boy can sense them and see them. But he's deaf, and he has problems communicating it to his parents. And it's definitely a terrifying deep cut that is worth the hunt.
Turek, is this a real movie? Look it up. Did she just make
this
up?
No. Believe her. Because I'm the one with the best memory here on the Shockwaves.
Okay.
She talked about this many episodes ago and said, it's either The Sounds of Silence or The Sound of Silence. I don't know. And we still can't figure it out.
I still haven't figured it out, and I own it. So I'm just going to...
Bring the VHS in.
I'm looking at it.
Let's watch it.
Pulling it up.
But the 80s were magic, weren't they?
I thought there was less scary stuff and just more fun
or
horror.
Or fantasy horror.
Fun.
But so much fun.
But thanks to Disney, there were moments of pure terror.
I mean,
the end of the black hole still sticks with me. Maximilian, like standing on the mountaintop, like fucking Satan. It's just like, oh my God. And then there's another great moment. Who remembers Dragon Slayer?
Oh, yeah. Dragon Slayer's good.
Yeah, Vermithrax is the greatest dragon of all time. Fuck you, Game of Thrones. No, Vermithrax is pretty badass. But there's a moment in Dragon Slayer where this village offers up this girl as a sacrifice to the dragon. And our hero goes into the dragon's cave to rescue this woman and hopefully slay the dragon. And the dragon had babies. And he finds the girl, and she's laying there, and the dragon babies are feasting on her slowly.
Ooh.
And you can see her foot, her leg, and then her foot way over here, and the baby's just munching on it. And, you know, when the movie came out, I was like 7 years old, and I was like, oh my God, what is going on? It was like pure terror, but that was... a family outing, that kind of movie. Yeah. You know, you wanted to go and see some spectacle and go see like Lady Hawk and stuff like that. You know, that's that kind of lumped in with us. Oh, Lady Hawk fans.
Yeah. Return to Oz. What the fuck?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. What are those things called?
Wheelers.
Wheelers.
Wheelers. Yep. Princess Mombi, that dude who ate people but was allergic to eggs. Yeah, there was a lot of crazy stuff going on.
Garbage
in that
Pail
movie.
Kids, the movie.
I loved that movie. So we were at...
Fucked up.
I was at a convention in... Oh, gosh. It was in Long Island. It was a comic convention in Long Island. And Sean Astin was there. And I brought my copy of the Garbage Pail Kids, the movie, and the Willies for him to sign. And yeah.
Mackenzie
was in it. Both of them were there. So I brought those two. And he was like, Garbage Pail Kids movie. And I was like, oh, no, you're signing it. So
I don't know why I know that Mackenzie is the star of Garbage Pail Kids.
Because he's awesome in it.
Were they your parents' bootleg copies you're getting signed?
No, no. Those were legit. I was living in New York on my own by that time. I bought tapes.
So. I just remembered, there's another one. This actually pertains to one of the guests. Billy Zane getting attacked by a critter in Critters.
Hey, yeah.
That scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
He was just hanging out in a barn with his girlfriend, and the critter just like, I remember he goes for his stomach, and he's holding this little fur ball, and I was just imagining like how deep that thing was burrowing into him. That's scary. That was scary to me.
Sounds of Silence with an S from 1989. Check out those pictures. It's a fucking terrifying movie.
All right, I guess we believe you.
That exists.
It exists.
It looks like Sinister.
It does.
Yeah. And don't forget Cujo.
Cujo.
I think when you're a kid, that's a really scary movie.
Yeah, I was going to say American Werewolf for me because it took me several... I just looked it up. It's to me, Michael Jackson's Thriller was a big gateway because I was 7 years old when that happened. And it was also the first time I saw like a making of where you saw Rick Baker doing these effects and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But they showed a snippet of American Werewolf in London in the making of Thriller, which is actually the whole... Piccadilly circus scene. Basically when pure chaos.
Yeah.
And I think it was the most violent thing I'd ever seen at 7 years old because it's like one guy like flies out of the bus and then gets run over when, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And so after that, I was like, well, I need to see that movie. and it literally took me several attempts. I'd watch it. And then when Griffin Dunn's character gets eaten, I turned it off. I was like, oh my God, because it was so violent. Mm. And then I made it up until when David has the nightmare sequence and he's like...
It's amazing how like a movie can have that many tones and work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's so funny, and then when you have this nightmare sequence, like straight out of a Buñuel movie, it's fucking terrifying. Mm-hmm. Nazi werewolves suddenly. Yeah. That's to me Landis's ability to juggle tones is pretty remarkable.
Twilight Zone the movie.
The introduction
of Twilight Zone the movie.
Want to see something really scary?
Girl with the no mouth. Yeah. What the fuck?
Oh yeah.
No, and again, granted, this is a kids movie, but it messed me up. Never-ending Story.
Oh yeah.
I will still, if anyone mentions our text, I will still cry my eyes out and fuck
is that
the wolf.
Horse?
Yeah, the wolf is
that's
terrifying.
My God, that was the saddest scene. That's probably the first time I've cried in a movie.
I think Kevin Dixon.
Our text drowns.
Somebody put, someone tweeted out to Twitterverse. It was like, what's the one on-screen death you're still not over, and Evan Dixon just put the horse in the quicksand, and I was like,
mud.
Oh my
he's
God,
in mud. He's
oh,
in a swamp.
Yeah,
so sad. I can't
and also
do
the witch in Krull 3D. If you watch the 3D version,
the witch?
Scary.
Oh, yeah. Cries
and with the spider. Ooh.
Flash Gordon.
Oh, really?
No, when he sticks his hand into the bog, and there's like this kind of bulbous thing with a stinger.
Yeah.
And like Timothy Dalton's like, I could do this. And I was like, yeah.
Eyeball, Eating Monster, and Deathstalker. Deathstalker, come on. Deathstalker, come on.
You know what? I want to put this out to the crowd and anybody who's listening. There's one film that I remember watching on WPIX Channel 11, and it was a film about a creature that would... like pull a piece of your vertebrae or your brain stem out, but that's what it ate. It ate like a very fine thread inside your brain.
And it's not brain damage.
No, it's not that. It was like, it wasn't the being, but there was this one movie. And I remember a girl in a garage in some city, and this monster came up to her, and her boyfriend was coming down to find her, and he just found like her laying on the ground with her back all torn up because the creature had just pulled that one little sliver of brain out. And to this day, I still can't find what it is.
Is it like an Outer Limits episode? Maybe?
No, it was a full movie. Wow. It was like on the level of The Being, where it was just a kind of a scrappy B movie monster movie from the 80s. And I still
And then in the 90s, you get the Relic doing the hypothalamus. Which is kind of funny.
Oh, the Relic. All right, well, 90s. You're just taking us to the 90s.
We have entered 90s.
But the problem with the difference now as viewers, though, is like now we have thick armor because the 80s is where we're kids. We're getting the shit scared of us. I feel like I went into every movie in the 90s looking for that, chasing that dragon with thick armor on me. So I think it was a lot harder to be scared.
But
for me.
Maybe.
All right. Well, let's hear what you got.
Okay, I'll kick it off because this one I saw unexpected, Event Horizon. Because that shit was marketed as a sci-fi film. And so I went in, sci-fi and not already. That I wouldn't have seen it if it was horror, but it definitely was not marketed like that. So you go in thinking it's going to be a sci-fi spaceship movie, and then they're eating their own hands and pulling their faces off. And yeah, I was not prepared for that. That is one that I definitely was still thinking about days later.
Because it was better than it had any right to be.
I know.
I think that was the surprise going into it. I remember once the main titles kicked off with an orbital Michael Kamen score where it was just like a little techno and a little classy soundtrack. I was like, oh, we're in for a good time. And then there, it was just like a roller coaster ride of scares. Mm-hmm. And then, it definitely stuck with me because like a couple days later, I was like, oh, the guy who did Mortal Kombat did all right this time around.
Yeah, it was one of the first films I remember the full black scleras effect. And yeah, it was just, it had.
But it scared you.
Definitely. Definitely. And I was like 16 by that time. So yeah, that one definitely kind of stuck with me.
That's a good flick, though. Yeah. Good. Sam Neill. Gotta love it. Yeah. He is home. I'm home. Who's going to say Candyman?
I am.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll let you
go. Well, then I'll let you
start. Are you guys Candyman too?
It was my second choice.
It was your second choice?
I start with you with Candyman.
It was just definitely my first choice. I mean, like, I just think on every level, the film is completely overlooked as one of the best horror film of the 90s.
And it does what Nightmare does. It creates a real boogeyman.
Bingo.
A real legend that you buy into and you're scared. And you don't want to look in the mirror. You don't want to say those words.
Exactly. And you get behind Virginia Madsen, who, you know, is kind of... She, you know, you emotionally connect with her because you know what her journey is, and then she goes poking around where she shouldn't go poking around, and then the most tragic thing that could ever happen to her happens, you know, and then it's still left open-ended.
And it's romantic. Like, I can't think of any horror films that have a deep romantic. There's a deep romantic
I think the romance comes... I felt more of the romance coming out of Candyman Farewell to the Flesh more than the first film.
I feel like there's such a pull from her to him.
It's romantic.
And a Philip Glass score, you know?
Yeah, no, God, the Philip Glass score is amazing. But that scene where she's been admitted and Candyman comes in and just fucks up her life even further. I mean, at that point, you knew that there were no boundaries. Like, you think that... Oh, with Freddy Krueger, you just need to stay awake. With Candyman, waking, sleeping, it didn't matter. He was going to come after you. And even if you were under the protection of the police or whatever, he was going to come and find you no matter what. That great scene where she's talking to the doctor and Candyman just, his hook comes right through the doctor's chest and he takes off. You're like, oh, wow.
And it's able to be topical, like modern, topical, looking at things, problems now, and then...
And still holds up today.
And tying it to the past. Yeah. He is a revenge character for America's past. Yeah.
Exactly.
The bloodshed in the past. Yeah. Slavery. It's really kind of an amazing character to have that through line. Yeah. That's a great, great freaking movie.
Yeah.
That would have been
Jacob's Ladder would have been probably.
Yeah, Jacob's Ladder.
Okay,
go ahead.
Well, Jacob's Ladder, I haven't seen it in a long time, and I actually just bought the Blu-ray. I want to rewatch it before probably getting into it too much. But there's scenes in that movie, like we talked about a long time back on Killer POV, about mindfuck cinema, like movies that are just literally a mindfuck, like a Lost Highway or that. But that film, you just never know where you lie with that narrator.
Yeah.
And there's a scene on a dance floor where the woman's like dancing
with
the guy, and the tail just impales her.
Yeah.
So it's like when you take reality, you're watching reality, and then something surreal or horror comes into that reality.
Sexual,
And then it's again tied to something political. It's tied to the war. It's tied to drug testing. You know, I need to see it again. Maybe I'll watch it in the next couple weeks just to have.
I remember,
a fresh
take. I think it just like ended on too much of an upbeat note.
Oh,
it's
really?
It ends on an upbeat
ending.
Well, it's such a bleak movie. I thought.
Well, it does.
Yeah, he comes around and
we'll talk about it after because
it's sad, but it's there's a there's a
it's like Owl Creek Bridge, but it goes opposite.
I just remember it not ending on a super dark note.
No,
because
it's really dark. We'll talk about it after.
All right, okay.
Homework.
No,
Jacob's
there
Ladder
are
panel
theories about Jacob's Ladder. We're gonna have a spoiler episode.
Yeah.
The ending fucked me up when I first saw
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah. I remember it as being uplifting. Like, it was
right, but if it's in his head, then you never know what's being actually played out to him. Okay.
I think it's a matter of perspective. Because once the reveal happens, then it's like, where can it go? And it didn't go where I thought it wanted to go. I didn't think it was going to go as dark. I don't know. I just remember going, oh, okay, good.
Okay. Revisiting.
For me, it's The Exorcist 3. Because I remember, and again, I had the thing with The Exorcist. I hadn't seen it that much, and me and my buddy Steve took the bus to the Limbrook movie theater. We're like probably 16 at this point, and we went to see this movie. We were pumped. We're like, we can handle it. It's The Exorcist 3, and there's still to this day, there's one, maybe two, but definitely one scare that is pretty much you can't redo it. There's one of the greatest jump scares of all time in The Exorcist 3. And just to prove it, I remember, several years later, I had showed it to a bunch of friends on Long Island, and they had never seen it, and that moment got them. Like, they all jumped off my couch, and I'm like, yes, it still works.
Yeah.
Much like the end of Don't Look Now. There's just these little moments that, I don't know, it's just a perfect storm. Somehow the way it's shot and executed with a little zinger sound effect or whatever. But Exorcist 3, I think, is a worthy sequel. And so to me, it's 1, 3 in the TV show.
And I think one of the reasons 1 and 3, it works.
Second season is awesome.
Yeah. Well, not number two, but number 1 and 3, it's saying, I delved into Ninth Configuration recently for the other show. And what I really learned by doing that was how William Peter Blatty is a true believer. Oh, and I think that's what you see in Exorcist 1 and 3. You see a guy who really believes this. And we talked about the new documentary by Friedkin where he filmed an exorcism. And what matters isn't like whether you believe in heaven or hell. What matters is they do. And so they really believe they're possessed, and they believe they can be unpossessed by a priest. And I feel like Blatty puts that into those movies where it feels real. Whereas another director could have made that same thing, and I think it would have felt like bullshit. Number two. Like, I don't think Borman felt that. You know what I mean? And so, I don't know. I think that's super important with belief, what you buy into with a movie. That's why these movies, a lot of movies we're talking about, are movies that ground a character as real.
Yeah.
We feel for them, and then you take us into a horror thing. Rather than, we need a horror scene in the first 2 minutes to catch the audience. It's like, generic.
Today's filmmaking.
I'm going to throw out a completely unreal character in unreal scenarios. House on Haunted Hill, the 90s one.
Bill Malone's movie.
Well, that's
Bill
a super Malone. Fun movie.
Yeah, it's super fun. I mean, nothing in it is in any way believable. But it scared the crap out of me when I saw it in the theater. It was one of those things, I just wasn't expecting it to kind of push as far as it did. And when Jeffrey Combs' character shows up, and they shoot it in, I'll call it twitchy cam. It was one of the first times I'd seen that done. They actually used the twitchy, you're literally just dropping frames and editing, but they'd used it on Jacob's Ladder was probably the first time I became aware of it, but they used it for walking in House on Haunted Hill.
Yeah.
And holy shit. And then he did the speed walk thing and that just, cool. It blew my mind.
Yeah, the first time you do something, anything like that, you've got the audience. Yeah. It's great. Yeah, that's a fun one.
It was really
I was gonna say Ring. Japanese Ring.
Yep.
Twitchy cam.
Yeah, that came out in the late 90s, but it's really, really well done. And I remember seeing a bootleg copy of that film, and that scared the shit out of me. I mean, it's a little bit of a slow burn, but once it got to that moment that we all know, I was on the edge of my seat, and I was like, I've never seen that before.
Yeah. So, no, I find that one much scarier than the American one.
Yeah.
But that's personal taste. 2000s? Are we in the 2000s?
No, I got one more. I'll give a deep cut, because that's what I do.
Go.
So from 1999, there is a really peculiar slasher film called Dead of Night. It's also called Lighthouse.
Yes.
That I've talked about on the show before, I think, when we did kind of like our favorites of decades. And it is about a prison ship it's prisoners, there's a prison nurse on board, some like prisoners who aren't that dangerous, and then there is the worst serial killer in history called the Headhunter. And they're transporting them to a new prison, maximum security prison in the middle of the ocean, and they crash into rocks, and they all wash up onto this island with two lighthouse keepers. And so then it becomes the guards, the prisoners, the nurse, the lighthouse keepers, and the serial killer who begins pecking them all off. And he's the headhunter, so his MO is collecting heads. And it's really tense, and because the light, you're dealing with like a lighthouse and there's a storm going on, so it's a really tense movie, slasher serial killer, and it's really creative. I love that one.
I remember seeing it on DVD or VHS. It was like one of those direct-to-video.
Yeah, it was like
I need to see that. I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, I always appreciate that one.
All right, the aughts.
The aughts.
The aughts.
The aughts.
Well, I know I saw. I looked at your list, and you have one that I was going to pick too. But
should I start with? Well, I'll start with the one that I don't know if it's the same one because there's two movies I think of. But the one that I only saw again for the first time about 4 weeks ago is the only time I've been scared, like actually, like felt actually quite unnerved by a movie recently in the last couple of years. And when I first saw it, I thought it was creepy, but it didn't have the impact it had this viewing. And that is Session 9. It scared. Yeah. Like, I was literally, I had forgotten all the twists. I'm just sitting at home watching it going, oh my God. It's saying maybe the Blu-ray just really made a huge improvement to this movie. And I find that, I think I would have just been so terrified to be in that environment, in that kind of space. It's so a bunch of people obviously have seen it, but it's about a bunch of guys who go in and they take out the asbestos out of the walls and kind of redo a space. And again, I think this is something about when you cast tough people who are strong and don't look like anything could scare them type people to be your leads, like when you cast George C. Scott, the two. You don't feel like George C. Scott could be frightened by anything, but then you have The Changeling and Exorcist 3, and you, I think you just believe it more. So these guys take this job, they undercut another group who were going to take longer, and they're kind of like, you're flipping a thing, but it's the Danvers State Mental Hospital. Yes. It's the real location, one of the last things ever done there. And this movie just has so much a creeping atmosphere, and it has lots of misdirects in terms of what kind of film you think you're watching. I definitely thought at one point, oh, I'm watching, you know, it's going to be kind of a Blumhouse-y Paranormal Activity movie or something at some point. And then it starts going to the kind of the human psyche, and the actors are brilliant. They're all like incredible casting. This movie, if you haven't seen it since it came out, I highly recommend that Blu-ray. And the extra features on there are great, where they're actually talking about Josh Lucas talks about how he thought it was an utterly terrifying experience. Like he talks about, like, really they all felt like this place was haunted while they're doing it. And he recounted a couple stories, and he just literally looked a little on edge even discussing it, which is, it's always kind of exciting when we have the mythos go from The Exorcist. Obviously had that because the set burned down and a lot of things around it, but man, that movie held up.
Sound design recording, so good. So eerie.
So that's one of them, but I know you probably mentioned the other one too.
Yeah, I'm going back and forth between the two that I picked, but they both come from the same place, which is basically in the 2000s is when things were coming out overseas first, and we kept hearing about them. And so my same cousin that I stayed up late with to watch exorcism stuff, we had reconnected over the Saw series and Dexter in the 2000s. And so we were always trying to find the next foreign film that was going to freak us out. And so there were things like High Tension. And I remember we got an import of The Descent, which is one of my picks, but I'll let you talk about
it.
And I mean, when you see The Descent without any context at all, first of all, I think what Neil Marshall did so brilliantly is he made an extremely claustrophobic first act. So I'm already kind of uncomfortable because of the situation. And then the second, I mean, it's almost ironically a found footage moment, because you're seeing something kind of shaky through a camera lens, and when you get the first glimpse of that there's more there, it's one of the scariest moments where you're like, holy shit, that's pretty fucking cool. But I'm going to left turn, because it was actually getting a Spanish DVD import of Rec.
Rec was
on my list.
And again, this is some of my least favorite things at that point in time. Found footage, I'm over. Zombie movies, I was kind of over at that
point.
Wait a
minute, you were over?
That was the
Rec was kind of
zombies
at the beginning. Well, not. I'm talking about found footage. Rec was kind of like the.
But I know. I don't.
I guess it was like 2 years before Paranormal.
I just remember it was things that I was not into at all. Like found footage and zombies? Nah, I don't want to see that at all. Yeah. And I got an import. I brought it over to my cousin's house. We watch it, and it's lean and mean. It's like 70 something minutes. It's really scary. It's all in real time. It's from kind of the perspective of this news report and these cameras, where they go into a kind of an apartment complex to investigate. It's like the fire. Basically, this news crew is going with a firemen's crew into a building to investigate something, and all hell breaks loose there.
Yeah. She's a news reporter who's just like tagging along. She's like doing like a fun, frivolous lifestyle
like
piece. And then it's like the older woman that they're just responding to, and they think it's just a heart attack or something like that.
And so when they go to the old woman, and she turns around and races at them full speed as a zombie, you're just like, holy shit. It doesn't let up from that moment, the whole movie. And so there's something scary about being along on that ride through basically through people's cameras. And not only that, and it, they remade it as Quarantine, which you know, less said about that, the better.
What about that trailer?
But they put the whole movie in the damn trailer.
Well, the ending,
ending and the poster.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that they didn't do in quarantine is, and again, theme, Exorcist, Entity, Exorcist 3, they drop a twist at the end of Wreck that's like, oh, now I'm scared.
Yeah.
That's where you're going? Fuck.
Yeah.
Well, showing you something that you couldn't imagine. Like that, you had a certain, you know, a physical, if you show a physical being that your brain couldn't, you haven't already seen before, and your brain can't get, like, imagine if that had just been what Mama is in Mama, how scary, which it kind of was.
And,
in the
it's, what's his name, Ryan? That was one of his first things.
Yeah, Javier.
Oh, it's Jaume Balaguero and Paco Plaza.
But,
Javier, the guy.
Javier Botet.
Javier Botet.
That was one of his first things. Was the wreck?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Creature. Yeah. Thing.
Because you sit there watching it, you can't imagine that it's a person. You can't imagine that. You know it's not CGI, so your brain can't explain it. And that,
well, again,
that's terrible.
Yeah. And done in night vision. Wreck is an amazing film, and I even pair Wreck 2 as being comparable to it.
I would question which one's scarier.
Yeah, I actually think Wreck 2 is actually a scarier film, but it's much more of a roller coaster ride. Whereas Wreck, it's like that sense of discovery. Wreck 2, you already know what you're getting into. Wreck 1, you're discovering as our news reporter's discovering. And that sense of discovery always works so well when you're trying to establish some level of scares. And I'm with you, man. That movie is terrifying. Yeah.
And I like the Wreck series, but I feel about it the way Elric feels about Nightmare on Elm Street, which is, I think, the first movie on its own, if there's never another one, would still be considered one of the scariest of all time. But then the fact that they kept going. And I like the third one, which is like a wedding and they just drop the found footage thing right away. Like, it's a fun franchise, but that experience of seeing the first one for the first time with no context is amazing. Yeah.
So I'll take off of that with no context zombies and say 28 Days Later, which I saw in the theater just expecting a zombie movie. And when you have the very first scene and he wakes up in the hospital and the zombie starts running at him, that was like a game changer to me. I remember thinking, like, wait, he can't do that. He's a zombie. They don't do that. It's wrong. And then just to see the whole rage zombie at that point, my brain could not comprehend that zombies, because it had built in for decades, you know, with just the Romero zombies that kind of move along and tend to hunt more in hordes than just solo chase scenes. But and the movie, just how it shifts and it goes through all of these different environments, like it worked for me.
That was the first one I remember was seeing for the first time that really captured George Romero's Night of the Living Dead for me. Like the idea of these characters stuck together, they don't all agree. I don't know. That was the first one that reminded me of like actually capturing that voice and spirit of
Romero. And because
Romero.
Zombie films are always best when they are political, like Romero was, and that one does. It shows like which groups would take over, who's going to take advantage of this like situation you're in, which I always think, and because they're never about the zombies being the scariest part. Usually, it's the people, you know.
Yeah, and you're right. Assault on Precinct 13 feels more like Romero's Night of the Living Dead than a lot of zombie films of that time period did. So 28 Days Later, when it came back, it just felt true, but even more scarier than anything I've
I think
seen.
The first few minutes of 28 Weeks Later is even scarier.
I think the opening
just the way
of
that
second
opens,
one
it's like
terrific.
Unrelenting.
I mean, 28 Days Later is one of my backups, but I think another backup of mine, Wreck, was my number one.
One
of my backups is Michael Haneke's Funny Games remake.
Remake.
The remake. Listen, I mean, I think there's just some sort of emotional disconnect I have with the foreign film, the foreign version, whereas I went into the remake. And I don't know. I was just like captivated by the rhythm of the dialogue and these characters. But once these kids started to manipulate and play with Naomi Watts and her family, Tim Roth.
Interesting cast.
Once they started playing with that, I was just invested all the way. Like every time, and I think it's not because I'm watching two stars. Get tortured by these two kids. It's because I don't know who these two kids are. I didn't recognize their faces. I had no idea who they were before I saw the movie, and just the stuff that they were doing. It's a very close remake of the first film, but I think that there was just like a weird disconnect I had with the first one. But this one, I just thought he did such a great job, just in design and tension. And I just remember like just holding my hands like this the entire time, because every time, you know, Naomi Watts was like trying to dry her phone, and then one of the kids just came in and was adjusting his glove. I was like, oh, fuck, don't do anything. Mm-hmm. Please don't do anything. And
it's
then
a lot like The Strangers, but without masks. If the Strangers characters took off their mask and just it's a more like real-time version.
Yeah, they're having a conversation. Yeah. It's a part of the conversation. Yeah. And then the film manipulation is a very frustrating one, but
self-reflexive side to it.
Yeah. But I was taken by it. I loved it. I love that little added bit to
when, you talked about Texas Chainsaw Massacre earlier and how Grandpa keeps dropping the hammer when he's trying to hit her in the head. Oh. That reminds me of the egg scene. Where it's like a splinter, like when you're standing there and you're trying to get a splinter out of your hand. It's what it like the churning in your stomach and there's like anxiety and
it's going back to that rhythm of dialogue that I'm talking about between the two actors, and he's like, I don't want to understand why you just don't give me another egg, and she's like, fine, I'll give you another egg, and then he drops it and he comes back and he's like, I'm sorry, I dropped the egg, and she's just like, and you're like, oh, what? There's so much tension in those moments.
It's so simple,
it's all about
it does
manners
so much,
too. It's like your manners. Oh, I'm sorry. And it's kind of frightening.
And Tim Roth being the audience going, what the fuck is going on here? I think he actually comes in. He's like, what's going on here? Why is this happening right now? And then just the child harm that comes with that movie too is just gut wrenching.
Totally. Yeah. All right.
I got a deep cut.
Oh, yeah, go
slightly.
For it.
Okay, deep Almost cut for there. The end of the aughts. Alex D. Iglesias. I'm going to say his name so wrong. I'm sorry about that. The Baby's Room from 2006. It was on Six Films to Scare
Keep
You.
You Awake.
Keep You
or
Awake.
Yeah,
thank you.
Great collection.
It's a really good collection, but that particular film, it's about a husband and wife who have just given birth, and he gets like one of these high-tech baby monitors with the video, and he starts seeing shit on it. And it's just really effective. It's small. It's basically just takes place inside the house, but yeah, it's just really effective. And it's one that I was burning my way through that entire series when it came out. And there's some really good movies in there in general. I highly recommend the Christmas one's really good. There's some great ones in there, but that was one that kind of took me by surprise, and it's got some really scary scenes in it.
Yeah.
So that's it. 2010s to now, right?
2010s.
What's still scary? Does anything scare you guys still? Do you still get scared by new movies?
Sinister.
Yeah. That is a scary one.
I haven't thought about that one.
What else?
That was my number one.
Yeah. Well, let's start with you.
Well, Sinister came in before I was Mr. Blumhouse.
Blumhouse rep.
But I saw it at a really early screening. It was actually, now that I am behind the scenes, I know what the screening was. It was basically a classic, hey, let's get some early, some critics to get some early tastemaker opinions. And Derrickson was there. But I just remember watching Sinister and getting the same feeling I got from watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the same time. The film opens with a snuff film on 8mm.
Yeah.
And it's done silently. There's maybe like a little bit of a droning happening, and you're watching a family get hung from a tree. And then when it stopped and Sinister came, like the title card came scrawled up on the bottom corner, I was like, oh, what are we watching?
Yeah.
Like, I just watched a snuff movie. And then it just further helped that I quickly identified with Ethan Hawke and his family, and I understood exactly where we were going, and I was emotionally invested in him. And then Derrickson was just he was just ratcheting up the tension, with his kid having night terrors, and the kid comes pouring out of the box in that one moment. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, okay, where are you going with this? The Bagul element, it's a little bit of a stretch. I mean, like, where are you going to go with all of this? But, what a brilliant device of discovering these 8mm home movies throughout the course of the film, and watching how Ethan Hawke kind of worms his way out of scenarios and engaging with his wife about, the fact that he moved his family into a murder house so he can become famous again and find inspiration for his new book. There's a great moment. I think it's just a really well-written scene where he's just up late one night with a glass of whiskey watching an old talk show appearance. You knew exactly what his motivation was watching that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Like watching...
Getting back to that moment.
Getting back to that, like, that's what I'm striving for again. And I'm going to do whatever I can to get to that and even put my family in harm's way, even though, there's not ill intent. It's just really wrong. But each of those home movies is really well done. Mm-hmm. The music that's accompanied by them, it's just something
Christopher
really
Young
wrong.
And a very odd score for him.
Well, it's not a lot of Christopher Young.
Oh, really?
A lot of that stuff is pieces of Christopher Young, but there's a lot of Boards of Canada. There's a lot of all these other bands that they pulled from.
Okay.
But they didn't, Christopher Young didn't do too many of the home movies. Those were all pieces of other artists' work.
Oh, wow.
Interesting. Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah.
It feels like a modern Stephen King thing that Stephen King would have done.
Well, the device of a writer,
Like The Shining.
Even the trailer, I remember being really kind of creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there's the lawnmower scene is like the one.
Oh, my God, the lawnmower scene.
I jump so high.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's the one that gets you.
Yeah.
It's off.
For me, it's The Conjuring, which I know is kind of an obvious answer, but here's why. So, obviously, James Wan, very talented guy, but our friend Joe Bishara not only composes music for James's films, but he's also the demon in all of them. So he's the demon in Insidious, and he did the music. He's the demon in The Conjuring. And so my experience of seeing these movies in the movie theaters was different. While everyone else was screaming, I'm watching like, oh, that's just Joe. It doesn't... Because if you ever meet him, he's the sweetest, most soft-spoken guy. And so to me, it's just goofy seeing him dressed in all black or as an old lady. It's just like, oh, that's just Joe. However, so I saw The Conjuring and I love it. I just think the craft of it is amazing. Mm-hmm. And then I bought the Blu-ray when it came out and I'm home alone. I think my roommate was out house-sitting something. So it's just me by myself late at night. I put all the lights out. I cranked the sound. I'm like, I'm going to watch Conjuring again. And I think it got to the moment where is there one moment where they're staring into a dark, but they don't show anything, like behind a door?
Into a closet, and then it goes up to the top.
Two girls in a bedroom, and one of them is looking off into a dark corner. And she's like, what are you staring at?
That's in the first Conjuring, right?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Why am I remembering a wardrobe?
Well, there's a wardrobe.
There's that, and there's one where on top of the... Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But I'm watching it late at night in my place alone, and that moment creeped me the fuck out. Like, I actually started to get scared, and it made me forget that it was Joe when he pops up or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, you know what? This is genuinely a pretty scary, solid movie.
Mm-hmm. James Wan, he knows what he's doing.
He does know what he's doing.
And add to that, I still think the nun scene in Conjuring 2 with the painting the scariest scene
in the last
few years. I mean, it's just, and that's Arishi, right? And it just shows you great things can come from that. Like, it's amazingly the way it's just put together as a constructed scene. It's so good.
Yeah.
What's your one, babe?
So I will say the one that I was alluding to before, which was the screening that I was at with you, Kane, where we saw Autopsy of Jane Doe, which...
Yeah, if you have not seen that, you like the best spook show of the last few years.
Yeah, it's not a film, like you're not going to be thinking about it 3 days later in comparison to your own mortality or anything like that, but it is a tight, like, hour and a half ride of just kind of being on the edge of your seat. And we saw it at Beyond Fest, and I remember just both of us kind of, there was this moment where midway through I was like, holy shit, this is good. And I was just so excited.
Again, you had no idea where it was going.
Yeah,
like,
none.
At all. You're just, it's these guys doing an autopsy on this woman's body that was found underneath the house. In an impossible circumstance.
A basement.
Where there's no way, all the doors are locked, but everyone's dead inside. And so no one, like, the cops are like, it makes no sense. Like, no one could have left and left the place locked like this, and yet her body was there. So they then do this autopsy, and as they peel back the layers on the autopsy, other things start to happen, and it becomes a very different movie.
Yeah.
And then it becomes really scary, because the filmmakers are ahead of us. You know?
And that was just one that I loved that screening so much. It was a reminder of what I love in horror movies, which is that rush, that sitting there and going, I don't know what the fuck's happening, but I love every minute of this. And it's just amazing. So that was a good one.
And that director's doing the same with Del Toro now, right? The Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Is that?
Mm-hmm.
But so, some more spooky stuff. Yeah.
And the writers behind Autopsy are doing a lot of exciting stuff as well.
Nice.
My one is definitely in the vein of you do not know where this is going. I saw a midnight screening, the premiere, it was called at AFI Fest in LA. And so no one really knew what this movie was. And I'm watching a film with a British hitman just killing people, and I'm going, cool, this is like a hitman thriller. And then it goes complete horror, nosedive, Wicker Man, and that's Kill List by Ben Wheatley.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that was one of my favorite screenings in my life because I had no idea what I was watching. And when it went horror with the tunnel stuff and the soundtrack, I was just left like in the dark at the end of that movie going, what did I just see? You didn't like that one?
Oh my God.
Oh man, I find that
I was thinking about days later. Yeah. Like the ending scene still disturbed the shit out of me.
Oh yeah, I love where it
still
goes.
Does now.
And it's not even the big stuff. It's kind of hard to tell without spoilers, but there's a dinner scene where, you know, you just think you're this hitman and you're hanging out with his buddies and like one of the guests of dinner does something in a bathroom and puts like a weird symbol on the back saying, and suddenly you're like, what kind of movie am I watching? And you realize it's more like a cult movie about a chosen person kind of thing. And if you're a fan of The Wicker Man, which I love the ending of The Wicker Man, obviously, obviously Turek disagrees. And
no, I mean, here's the thing.
Do you?
What are you? Out of your mind?
No. Sure.
We're talking about Kill List.
Okay.
No, I need to rewatch Kill List because I saw it. I've only seen it once. I had a similar opinion when I saw Session 9. The first time I saw Session 9, I literally flipped off the screen because I was so mad at it. And then I came out on DVD and I rewatched it and I was like, this is a brilliant piece of cinema.
Yeah.
So I need to do a revisit of Kill List. Okay. Right now, I'm just kind of like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Oh, man, I love that film.
That totally affected
any
me.
Any Kill List fans?
Okay.
I think Ben Wheatley's an acquired taste.
Yeah, but that one I think is still his most accessible. You know, I think
really?
Yeah, because most of his films take too big a tonal, kind of cartoon tonal shift.
Free Fire?
Huh? Right, John?
Is it Free? Is it free fire?
Free Fire. Yeah. That's fun.
Might be his.
Sightseers is fun. Yeah, that's comic.
I'd say that.
But this is the only
I'd
one that's
it's
like
an acquired
horror.
Taste as well. Yeah.
I know. To me, it's mainstream. I mean, deep cuts over here.
What?
All right, Rob.
And no one said It Follows.
Oh, I did.
It Follows? No one?
It's
Follows?
My backup.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's one of my backup
ones. I watched that one with you, too, and you loved it.
You loved it, but you didn't.
I was okay with it.
Look, if you get when to see it before out, the hype, though, like, again, it felt like discovering one of these movies that came out that no one had talked about. But what I loved about it was the first movie in my, like, kind of adult lifetime where I didn't know what was going to happen in the frame. So I'm just watching it on a big screen, and your eyes are like a carpenter frame. Constantly going, where is it going to come? What is it going to be? And there is a moment where a giant walks under. You see a girl walking in one direction, and when they cut to the other side, a giant walks through the door. That is shit you cannot prepare
for. And the music does a very distinct sting that gets you on edge.
That was kind of ruined for me because afterwards the director was there and he was telling stories about the movie. He goes, you would be surprised how hard it was to find a giant in Detroit. we're just like, you know, the practicalities of making a movie. We need a giant.
We need a giant in Detroit.
But I think that movie did such a great job of like being about something that you can't put its finger on.
Yeah.
And everyone, a lot of our friends who would complain to me about the movie, like, it doesn't follow its own rules. The idea that, like, we need rules to be scary is insane to me. Like, sometimes you need something that you can't pin down, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it's a great film.
Yeah.
That was one that got better on repeat viewings.
Mm-hmm. Mine,
like,
too.
I enjoyed it on the first one, but I watched it again when it came out on Blu-ray. And the second time, knowing where it goes, I was just so impressed with how the camera is constantly moving. Much like you have to be constantly moving. Yeah. Just the entire time, if you pay attention, it's like there's always movement or something happening. And it kind of just adds to the eerie feeling of what's actually happened within the movie.
Yeah,
and I believe John Carpenter is a fan of this movie. Mm-hmm. I think him and Sandy had said it was one that they liked a lot. So if he likes it, come on.
The first time I saw it, I was not annoyed, but just kind of rubbed the wrong way about the repetitiveness of it, where it was like, something's chasing us. Let's run here. Something's chasing us here too. Let's go here. And literally the film is built out of five or six of those let's run, oh it's here, let's run, oh it's here sequences. And so that really grated me the first time I saw it. And it wasn't until the second time that I was able to really appreciate that even though it is built out of those five sequences that feel very repetitive, the way that they build the scares in each one is really well crafted. And it's definitely like, got good jump scares.
And it's like that great Twilight Zone I think we've talked about a number of times with the box, where you get a box and you could push a button and it's going to kill someone. You know what it's going to happen once you pass it on. It's the same thing. Like, this has actually got a moral dilemma, which is to not get killed by this thing. You have to pass it on to someone.
Yeah.
And it's all about, like, modern sexuality and dating and how sex has become this kind of a transaction of a type.
Oh, yeah. When Michael Monroe meets those guys in the boat, my heart sunk.
It's bleak.
Like, I was just like, damn.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
And kind of, it could be one of those cases where we always talk about Nightmare on Elm Street and Wreck, like what we were just saying about, man, don't make a sequel and this will always stay scary. There's a part of me that straight away wants a sequel and then realizing that will ruin it.
You don't want a sequel.
But I want a sequel, but I also know that will be the end of it. So anyway.
I will add The Last Shift, just because I saw that one. it was like a Netflix find one night where I'm just going through Netflix, and we're friends with the director. Anthony de Blasi. And I knew he was working, and I was like, oh, Anthony's new film's on here, and I knew nothing about it. And that one kind of fucked me up for the night just because it's so intense. It comes at you kind of slowly, and then once it hits, it's just throwing scares at you back to back. It's very psychological. That one. And it's got some really great gore sequences in it, too. So that one came completely unprepared and had no idea what to expect, but it was a really good scary ride.
And the listener's pick we have to mention, because it reminds me of that and the ending of Rick, which came to us from listeners of the old show, which is Taking of Deborah Logan.
Oh, yeah.
Which none of us was on none of our radar, and listeners kept saying, Taking of Deborah, this new movie on Netflix, and then we all watch it, and we all equally were like, those last moments are, again, something you can't expect what you're seeing, and it's found footage. You wouldn't think you would be as excited, but so there's still spooky shit. We could still kind of be...
What'd we miss, guys? What'd we miss?
Anything you're just...
The Witch!
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The Witch is... I think it's more dread.
No.
I think it's... Was it scary? Yeah.
Yeah. The opening scene?
Yeah. I think I just totally forgot about The Witch, to be honest. Yeah. And even though it's a great movie, I've only seen it once. And again, I love these movies where you just can't wait to see what the person does next.
Mm-hmm.
That and It Follows, they're like, I want to see whatever they make next.
Yeah. Right. Totally.
So anything else we totally dropped the ball on? Which one?
Gerald's Game?
Oh, Gerald's Game
did have a pretty...
Super tense.
Gerald's Game.
Yeah, Gerald's Game.
There was a moment. I don't know if it scared me. It just made me wince.
Yeah.
And there's an incredible Netflix video where they show it to that scene to Netflix employees. And seeing their reaction. It's on YouTube.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, where they just like literally sit them down and their reaction is priceless.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Raw.
Yeah, The Invitation. A lot of those are like about it's the idea that's scary. Raw and Invitation. Yeah. It's like the concept, the last image is what scares you. There's dread built, kind of like Don't Look Now, I guess, in the same way.
I think what we're getting is a lot of dread-filled movies, where you're just kind of unsettled by an idea or a scenario.
Yeah.
Well, I think Raw definitely has the repulsion element as well.
I was in a screening
where like people walked out of it like
mentally.
The shock value and repulsion.
Yeah. So that is our by decade. Why don't we just like open for a few questions, because we'll never be in the room, very likely until next year. So we'll repeat the question so listeners can hear it.
At home.
So let's fire away.
Yes.
Scariest and most funniest movie.
Most funny movie? For me, Evil Dead 2, because it has both for me.
Oh, yeah.
Especially at the right age, you get both. You get a beat of scary and then it's hilarious.
Shaun of the Dead, the Don't Stop Me Now scene.
It's good, yeah.
Really good scare, and then it got hilarious, but yet terrifying.
It's a hard thing to do, keeping those two things next to each other, I think.
Yeah.
Derek?
American Werewolf.
American Werewolf.
Okay. Yeah.
The best balance of it.
Uh-huh.
But Evil Dead 2 is pretty darn.
Yeah. That's kind of the ideal.
Yeah.
Any others?
Yes.
Do we have a movie that we're angry that somebody made us watch it?
That's a good question.
Let's talk to everybody. Turk has dated before.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not. What is it?
Martyrs.
Remake?
No, Martyrs. The remake or the original?
No, the other one. the remake. I won't say who.
Oh.
Yeah, God.
I will say, I dated a guy who knew I was really into horror, and so he really wanted me to see Captivity and the Courtney Solomon film. Not my cup of tea. And that was one that I was just like, this is like just mean. But I know people who love that movie. But that was one that I was kind of like, dude, I wish I hadn't watched this. I didn't go back out with him.
I mean, Brian Collins and I went and saw that awful Hellraiser movie. The one before the one
Fat
that just came out. Fat
Pinhead?
Not Gary Tunnicliff's, the other one.
Yeah. I remember that was a bad choice.
Yeah.
I was pretty angry about that.
Yeah.
I bet we made some of you angry at watching like Kathy's Curse or something, right?
We probably made you guys watch some movies.
I'm feeling
that
like
you're
this
like
be some Devil's Honey anger at
oh my gosh, Devil's Honey.
I stand by it.
I stand by it as well. Go to the Severin booth, watch Devil's Honey. You will see some stuff you've never seen before. I don't know if it's good or bad, but you've never seen it before.
It's not good, but it's something.
Yeah.
But
it's special.
It's special.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you.
Yeah.
Do you think the 80s was better because we couldn't fact check like things like Exorcist or whatever? Or I actually thought Texas Chainsaw Massacre was real for a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we will never get back to a period because everything is let me fact check everything first before whatever?
I don't think
so. Were the
80s better because we couldn't fact check?
I don't think it's about.
Or
I don't think it's
better
about,
just because we were kids then.
No, I don't think it's about that. I think it's about the there was a, it was a freer time for filmmaking. You know, 70s was about class, and 80s was about the studios coming around and understanding that you can make money and mm-hmm. you have blockbusters. But it was also a freer time where Toby Hooper can sneak through an Invaders from Mars remake, you know?
Yeah. There was a lot, but it's just like a lot of opinion. Well, no, we also get drowned by other people's opinions before we even see something.
Well, what I'm just saying is that it's just like there was a lot
there
was a larger tapestry of shit getting made that will never, ever get made today, ever. Like, you'll never get a Return of the Living Dead on the level of Return of the Living Dead. You're never going to get a Reanimator again. You know, you're not going to get that stuff.
We say as if one is uploaded to Netflix on Friday.
Well, right now. I don't count.
Somebody just shot one on his cell phone right now.
I don't know if you even realize there's a new Reanimator movie from Italy on Netflix as of Friday, and none of us even had a clue. It doesn't look good, but it's there. Yeah.
I also think that the actual business side of the 1980s movies really played into kind of what made it so desirable, because you had the boom of the VHS market. And as soon as that happened, people literally just started throwing money at horror films because they could see how well they were doing. I mean, that's how Frank Henenlotter got money. These are not films that studios would have made, but they were just throwing money.
Yeah, but and, I think it's more, to his point, it's like, when I saw Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer and it said, based on a true story, I thought, holy shit, that really happened. And that's as close as it happened.
Whereas
when Platinum Dunes kept putting based on a true story in front of every one of their movies, I was like, that's a horse shit. And I remember walking out of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the 2003 one, which I do like, but people in my audience were like, oh my god, he's still out there.
Yeah, but you, Elric, Becca, and I are a microcosm on a larger scale. So when someone goes to see The Strangers, they believe that because it's
I Q&A'd Katie Featherston, and she was talking about how people actually send her letters about their own paranormal experiences and possessions because they actually think she's been through it and they want to commiserate with her. Yeah. So I think that, to many people, it's still, there's a reality to it.
I don't know. I also don't discount, like, to me, things like Rotten Tomatoes, all this stuff, it's problematic because you can't not get some sort of opinion before you see it. And the way we used to watch movies, we got this golden period where all I knew is what was on the back of the VHS cover. Right. And I had no one to ask. Maybe I could crack open Leonard Maltin or something. But the going from picture to picture and deciding what to watch with no influence was a golden period. So the movies had to be good, but that was a magical period.
I watch stuff like that on Netflix all the time.
It's not the same. You like it's just pictures. I don't know. It's lost something. Now that's also because we had that experience. So if you'd never had that experience, I don't know what it would be like now. Maybe Netflix does provide that.
Of course, being part of this, I hear about the bulk of films that are coming out, but then there are always ones like Last Shift where I'm literally like, I don't know what this is. Taking of Deborah Logan. I don't know what this is.
Occasionally you can get those,
You know, it's a complete virgin viewing. I have no idea what's going on.
I mean, does anyone do what I do, trying to avoid a trailer now? I mean, has anyone not seen the Hereditary trailer? Yeah.
No,
like, I'm only hearing it, and I can't stop that. But
I was sitting with him, and he literally went like this,
But, like, I'm not kidding. Now I have anticipation, something I had as a kid. If I had seen the trailer, I would just be going, oh, that'll be good. But now I have, like, genuine anticipation. I might be disappointed, but who cares? But I'm excited about it. I think to stay in love with movies, you've got to keep finding ways for you to do it as the viewer. And if that means blocking certain things, block it.
Yeah, it's like take Rotten Tomatoes out of your favorites.
Yeah,
Listen, don't go on Twitter. That's the thing. Or unfollow the people that are constantly the tastemakers that are talking about these movies really early on. It pisses me off to no end. Right before the Avengers, it was all these think pieces about, oh, what about this thing that happened in Avengers Infinity 4? I'm like, dude, it's Thursday at 3:00. Yeah, Can you just give me a few more hours before you start pushing your think pieces on me about it?
But it used to be your job to do this, and mine too.
Yeah, no, but I never did that.
We had to do them.
But it's gotten worse.
Yeah, it's
gotten much worse.
Yeah, that's a good question, I think.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, how does this guy not have Scream?
That's like your jam.
That movie's fun.
That
opening scene, I think, when we first saw it.
Yeah, but as a body of work, as a whole, it was more of a fun. It was a fun roller coaster ride to me with a lot of scary bits in between. Yeah. I mean, that movie, you know me.
You made all documentary.
It didn't scare me, but I was so excited when that movie came out. The opening scene is still one of the greatest openings to a horror movie ever.
What it does,
love letter to horror films.
Yeah, what it does is it does exactly what American Werewolf in London does, which is it tells a scary story first and then it throws in the laughs in between, and it does a really good job of that. I think it was the last good movie that did that. You know, Shaun of the Dead isn't a horror comedy. It's a comedy.
I would even venture to say Happy Death Day delves into
Happy Death Day gets close to that.
It gets close.
Cool.
It's fun.
Cool.
We were all surprised. We liked it so much. So
yes, in the blue shirt.
I was going to ask, what's something that's not really traditionally seen as a horror movie that really stuck with you after you remember being 18 and watching Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah. Oh, right. God, yeah.
So bleak where it goes. Yeah.
Yeah. Movies that are not traditionally
That's definitely a nightmare movie.
There is a French filmmaker.
Don't forget to repeat the question for
yes,
that.
Sorry, yes, sorry. What are non-traditional horror films that stuck with us like horror films? Yeah. There is a French female filmmaker whose last name I'm going to slaughter. Catherine Brunet?
Brunet.
Fat Girl. Her film Fat Girl.
Yeah, Fat Girl's a great one.
Weeks afterwards, I was still like having shudders from that. Dogtooth was another one where like days later, I was still like, I don't know what I watched, but it destroyed me for a couple of days.
Yeah. Platoon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. More I mean, like, that wasn't my era. That was not my thing, you know, but my dad kept Platoon away from me for a really long time for a good reason. And then I watched it by myself and I was completely destroyed because, I mean, like, I think it was the first war movie I had ever seen, too. And to have such a, it just has a visceral quality to it and just such heartbreaking moments that I mean, it stuck with me for sure. I mean, that's like the horrors of war, and Oliver Stone did a great job with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you. The first few Darren Aronofsky movies. Like, I've only seen Pi once. I never want to see it again. Requiem for a Dream, I went to go see in Manhattan with a full theater, and nobody moved. When it was over, nobody said a word, and we all sat there until the end credits. And I never want to sit through it again.
Oh,
and it's
you know
a
what?
Great movie.
Going back to your question about movies that somebody pushed on me, and I got angry about it, Requiem for a Dream. Fuck that person. I was really angry after I, because he was like, come see it. And you know what? And he's listening and he knows. I'm sorry, Jared.
Oh, it's Jared?
Yeah. I remember seeing that. I was so mad. I was like, I wasted my time. I was so
mad. But why mad? You didn't think it was a good movie?
I hated it.
Are you serious?
I've never seen it again. I've never seen it.
I think they should show it to high school students.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Show that to high school students.
I totally agree. And that would be my pick, too, as a movie. I always think if you showed it to all high school senior boys, rape would decline rapidly, and that's irreversible.
Oh my God.
You couldn't, as a human being on this earth, watch that movie and then want to emulate the things you see in that. It's so painful and grotesque, and it shows what's being lost, what you strip away from humans' dreams and hopes, and it shows it in reverse order in a way that's utterly painful, and it's not a pleasant movie, and no one wants to rush out and see it, but seeing it one time, it's an experience. That's probably one of my favorite subgenres are movies that are, they're like Deliverance. It's a drama, maybe a thriller, but it has this horror. I could even cite a comedy that I felt that way about, which is easily my worst date of my life, was Happiness by Todd Solondz. Man, we had this hot thing going, and we're excited to meet, and we finally met, and we went to Happiness, and oh, man. I was laughing the whole way. She wasn't. weird like parental sodomy thing with tuna fish did not go down well. But it's such a bleak, like it's like a director going, oh, here's my portrait of something funny, but you're like, it's also hell. You've also shown like this dark layer. Yeah.
I picture so many dates going wrong that way from Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Oh, yeah.
Where
yeah,
it's like totally. One person's cracking up and the other person's just horrified. Yeah,
yeah. No, but that would be parents going out on a date. Yeah. Like, we've got babysitters, we're going to go to a movie about killing our kids.
It's got Nicole Kidman in it. It's going to be great.
It's one of my favorites.
That's a great, it was like one of the best films of last year if you haven't seen it.
I think we have time for one more.
Was that way as well.
One
more question. Way in the back.
Way
in the back.
Oh, shit.
What's our favorite VHS cover
ever? Separating the movie from it, I loved the cover to Body Shop when I was a kid. Like, the movie, it's not good. But the cover, puffy 80s, like, hair and just this hand laying next to it.
And of a woman's head.
And a head, yeah. And I will also say the dead pit because the eyes lit up. It's pretty badass. Bleeders. That was not, I think Bleeders was more 90s, but it had the squishy cover.
Yeah, the squishy cover. So. I'm going to say The Mutilator.
Oh yeah,
yeah. That's a great VHS cover.
That's pretty good. What about you?
Yeah.
So I actually went on this little tangent a few days ago of videotapes that used to use Freddy and Jason as the selling point. And one I have is a movie called what's it called now? Oh, Junior, which is literally it's the greatest cover of this dude with a chainsaw going through the cover, and he's like, you've met Freddy, you've met Jason, now meet Junior, or something along those lines. And that dude is nowhere in the movie. It's like it's a terrible, terrible movie, and it's nothing like that cover. But then I went down that rabbit hole where then, Sleepaway Camp 2 uses that iconography, and Night of the Demons, Angela's having a party, Freddy and Jason are too scared to come. Yeah. And so I was like, how many Freddy Jason covers are there out there? There's probably a lot.
Yeah,
Which
Mikey.
One?
Mikey.
Mikey.
Mikey, yeah, the kid one, yeah. So that's
oh, it. The other one was the other one too is Deadly Spawn.
Oh yeah,
that's a good one.
Yeah, but not the painted one. It's just a photograph
of the creature
Of the creature in a black room, yeah. And then there's just like a body part, and it's like, oh, that works.
I'll also say Elves. The cover cover was great. The movie's like a lesson in why Grizzly Adams shouldn't smoke, but literally he like it does not stop, like it's crazy through the movie. But yeah, the cover was really good. Blood Beach, I'll throw in that same category.
Yeah, good,
brilliant
good
cover. The movie was kind of a cop drama with maybe something under the sand.
You disappoint me.
Yeah, it's not my jam.
Get that Vinegar Syndrome for that Demon Wind cover, because that Demon Wind cover is enough to make you watch that movie, and then you'll be like, eh. But still, you know, go buy it. Go spend your money on it.
Yeah, there were so many like that. Like Microwave Massacre is incredibly deceptive.
Elric's favorite.
Elric's favorite.
I don't like that movie.
All right.
Is that it?
I think we're going to wrap up, guys.
Yeah, we'll wrap up with Microwave Massacre. Really?
That's where we're going to go, guys? What other way is there?
Just say Frankenhooker so we can say one a day and then call it a day.
Come hang out if you have other questions.
We'll be at the booth 29 and 30 in the main room.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take photos.
After we got five minutes here. Yeah.
Come hang out.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much. Shockwaves Podcast. Here. Thank you.